To another session in our spring 1989 series of IBRI colloquia. IBRI is a name for the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institute, which sounds like a large endowed operation, etc., but it's actually a mailbox down in the Hatfield Post Office and a few cabinets up here. we, however, do hold a series of colloquia monthly here at Biblical. We have a series of about 36 research reports currently, have published 3 books, and hold a series of seminars on origins. Our concern is interaction between the Bible, Christianity, and various academic areas. This evening, we're happy to have one of our biblical grads, Reverend Daniel R. Young, speak on the subject of rock music and holiness. Reverend Young received a B.S. in Bible and a B.A. in Music from Philadelphia College of the Bible back some years ago. MDiv and a MA, what's that, New Testament, from Biblical Seminary, is currently working on an MA in counseling here, and is been associate pastor for, 9 years over at First Baptist Church of Doylestown. And so he's working where the rubber meets the road. He's doing some music directing over there and doubtless counseling a number of teenagers dealing with this whole area of rock music. So we're glad to have him come and speak to us on this subject.
Someone has said that one man's noise is another man's music. Perhaps there's no more truth in that statement than in the topic of our discussion tonight in regards to rock music. For several years, I've been working on this topic. I started collecting information on it when I was a freshman in college, and I've continued that. When I got out of college, Philadelphia College of Bible, I started here at Biblical Seminary, and in the meantime, I was working as a part-time youth pastor at First Baptist in Doylestown. I did that for about 6.5 years. Eventually, it went full-time about the third year, also working in the area of music over there. I experienced a lot of frustrations between teens and their parents over this issue of rock music. Of course, having been collecting data for quite a period of time, I really began to work on this with the hopes of acting as a shepherd between those young people and their parents and helping to bring some type of resolution to that situation. Eventually, out of that study and the work with those young people and their parents came this study. I've had the opportunity of sharing it in all kinds of situations now. I trust that you'll find it helpful. I've just reworked it again, so I'll get it a little bit more up to date. As I work through the information which I've prepared tonight, I want you to realize right up front that I really do not intend to talk about particular groups, individuals, performers, and the reason for that is about 6 months from now, some of the hot ones presently on the market will no longer be there. The issue is really not the performers. That's just a symptom of some of the deeper issues which we really would like to deal with tonight. So what I would like to do is not treat the symptoms, but I would like to get below that level, and I would like to approach it from a topic from a standpoint that I don't think you often hear. I've worked hard at this. I would like to approach this from the standpoint of a biblically trained musician. I've done some graduate study work over at Westminster Choir College to beef up in some areas that I felt needed strengthening, and those things have been a help to me as I've prepared this study. I'd just like to share some of the difficulties that I've sensed with you in this area and then go on and make some what I hope will be very helpful suggestions. To help you understand where I'm coming from a little bit better, let me explain my beliefs on the issue, first of all, of amorality of music. If you've done any reading in this area, you know that there's quite a debate that rages on. Does music have morality in and of itself, or do we give it morality? I really don't want to get hung up in that study tonight. My personal belief is, and I'll be sharing this in much more depth later on under the objections in your outline, my personal belief is that music is just like anything else that God created, sex, humor, whatever. As man interacts with that thing and uses it in given situations, we either use it immorally or we use it morally. We use humor immorally, we have dirty jokes. If we use it from a moral standpoint for what God created it for, we have good, wholesome humor. In the area of music, I see a very similar parallel. Music in and of itself is not the thing which is to be blamed. Music will not eventually stand before God to give an account. Man will, in relationship to what he has done with the great things that God has created for us. I would encourage you to watch the outline. I will stick with it closely. And you can just kind of jot things down if you want to. Please feel free to write all over that thing, to write questions on the back at the end. I would like to just have time for your questions. And we'll just see where we go from here with your questions. Let me begin Roman numeral 1 with a major problem in the discussion of rock music. Actually, I think the problem is a twofold problem. First of all, I want to deal with the subjective nature of our discussions of rock music. I've heard parents tell their children, sure, come on in, let me give you an outline here. I've heard parents tell their children that they're not to listen to any rock music at all. And of course, the child reluctantly will agree to that, at least in some cases. And then later on, when the parent hears the child's stereo playing, the parent says, I thought I told you no rock music. And the child says, I'm not listening to rock music. That more or less marks the beginning of World War III in many households. At least that's been my experience as a youth pastor. I've seen it over and over again. And that just sort of points out to me that there is not a clear definition of what rock music is. Why is it that a parent can consider one song rock music and a child turn right around and honestly say, no, I don't think it is? And then it gets even more difficult when a parent might say, I don't want you to listen to any hard rock, only soft rock. Now, of course, the difference between the two, and in mom and dad's mind as versus the child's mind, are two very, very different things. So there's a very subjective nature to this whole problem. And I found myself constantly frustrated dealing with young people and them saying, my mom and dad say I can't listen to this kind of music, so I listen to something else and they call that rock and they call it hard. That's not hard rock. We have these kind of non-technical subjective terms, hard rock, soft rock, light rock, and so on. And really what is necessary is what I've listed as the second part of this problem. What we really need to clear up this subjectivity is a clear, concise, understandable definition of rock music. One of my goals tonight in this presentation is to help you so clearly understand what rock music is that anytime you hear it, either hard stuff, soft stuff, whatever, you'll be able to immediately identify it. And I think each of you ought to be able to do that tonight when you go out without any real difficulty. In fact, within about 15 minutes, I think we'll be at that point. That is one of my goals, to help you and give you that objective basis from which to move into discussions. So, look at Roman numeral 2, the definition of rock music, and I've printed it there in your notes. Definition: rock music is a style of music characterized by the beat. The beat must have a syncopated beat as well as a subdivided beat. You'll note that there are four underlined areas in that definition. Each of those needs to be unpacked, if you would, so you can understand what it means. Because if you just look at that definition, you say, boy, I'm no further ahead than when I came in. You will be in a moment. Let's look at each of those four underlined phrases. First of all, would you note that rock music is a style of music? Oftentimes, people will think rock music is a bunch of guitars and drums and loud volumes of music and so on, and that's basically the way they define it. It's not. It is a style of music. A style of music, just like any other style of music, have certain characteristics about it that identify it from distinguish it from other styles of music. In the sport baseball, things that are characteristic of baseball are things like a glove, a bat, a ball, and so on. So in the area of music, whether you're talking, well, I trained in the area of brass performance. I'm a trumpet player. So there's Italian Baroque trumpet music. That doesn't mean too much maybe to some of you, but there are certain characteristics about Italian Baroque trumpet music that set it apart from French trumpet music. Vastly different, immediately distinguishable. What we want to do is find out exactly what those distinguishing marks are of rock music that distinguish it from other styles. So as soon as you hear rock, you'll be able to distinguish it. It is a style of music. That is, there are certain distinguishing factors about rock that distinguish it from anything else. any other form of music. Notice, second of all, I've said that the chief characteristic of rock music is its beat. Some people will immediately say, I knew it, that terrible stuff, that beat. Actually, though, it is not one beat. As I've underlined further, it is two beats. In fact, it's the combination of the two beats that forms the rock style. So rock music is a style of music, and its chief characteristic is its beat. Actually, its beat is two beats. First of all, a syncopated beat, and second of all, a subdivided beat. Now, what we need to do is understand what those two beats are so that we will eventually then be able to put them together and understand rock. First of all, the syncopated beat. Syncopation is often misunderstood. Harvard's Dictionary of Music, classic work for musicians, defines syncopation as altering a beat from where it normally is. So if it's normally here, you put it over here, you alter it. And what that does is it adds musical interest. Syncopation is used through music, all styles of music. Classical music is loaded with it. So, little example over here. In traditional 4-4 common time music, what I've done is I've drawn a measure there. Four quarter notes. The 4-4 over by the G clef means that there's four quarter notes to a measure and that the quarter note gets to be. How many of you have some kind of musical understanding? Did you understand what I'm saying? Good. Good number of you. And those of you that don't, that's okay too. In 4-4 time, generally, which beats you see the accent? 1 and 3. That's correct. So, 1, 2, 3, 4. Normally, 1 and 3 receive the beat. Now, if you're going to syncopate the beat and you're going to put it in a place other than where it normally is, what's left? 2 and 4. The rock beat will always accent 2 and 4. That's one of the two beats. So you have 1, 2, 4, 2, 4. That beat will always be there. Now, when you combine that with the second beat that I've called the eighth note driving beat, the subdivided beat, what we have subdivisions simply means you divide it down. When you divide a quarter note, what do you get? Musicians, help me out. Come on. Eighth note, sure. So, if I divide down my four quarter notes, I'm going to come up with 8 eighth notes. So while you have this accent going on 2 and 4, now you're going to add a constant, kind of a driving, subdivided beat. So in just a very easy tempo, 1, 2, 3, 4, you got to accent 2 and 4. 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2. That's your first beat. That's the syncopation. Now what you've got to do with that 4-4 is you've got to add the eighth note. The eighth note would sound dot, 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 dot. It just continues on and on and on. When you put the two together, you have the eighth note. And on 2 and 4, you have to add the accent. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. That probably does a lot for your microphone, doesn't it? That's the rock beat. That's what distinguishes rock music from anything else. Now, because rock is distinguished by its beat, watch this. Because the beat is the distinguishing factor, the beat can easily be added to a musical style of any other style. That's why rock beat is often mixed in with country western. That's why it's mixed in with jazz and blues. That's why you hear it in the styles of music that you're sometimes accustomed to hearing in church. I'd like to play several examples. As you begin to mix the rock beat in with some of the different other styles of music, sometimes it becomes almost impossible to tell what styles. Maybe there's 2, 3, 4 styles of music all going on in one piece at the same time. And you get this collage of styles going, and oftentimes out of that form, new styles of music through the history of music. Let me play an example of music, though, that I think will help you to identify that accent on 2 and 4 as well as the eighth note. Hopefully I'll be able to help you distinguish them. Let's see. popular rock. Four, one, two. You'll pick up the two and four right away. Now listen for the eighth note. One, two, three, four. One, two, three. Hear it? Anybody struggling to catch it so far? All right. Let me play another one. Not that one yet. Don't want to get to that yet. Another fairly easy one to identify it in. Two. Two. Now here it's a very fast subdivision pattern. A lot of it's in the cymbal. See, it's a little more mixed there. Harder to distinguish it. But the thing that is always distinguishable is that two and four. That'll cue you right away. That's probably rock. And then you might have to listen harder for the eighth note subdivision. That's why I played that, because there the eighth note is not quite as clear. If you concentrate at it, you work hard at it, you'll be able to hear it. But a lot of times as you start adding a number of instruments, it gets hard to hear that constant eighth note drive, especially when they drive these things at such high volumes. Now, we've identified what rock is. Listen. There's a rock beat in there with some other styles going on too. That's off Easy 101, those of you that know that station. In fact, what that says is most of the music that you hear in the dentist office and the grocery store probably has that beat added to it, because it does add a fair amount of rhythmic interest and it keeps a soft, slow song like that moving. Now, the moms and dads that fight with their kids in our churches don't realize that that is rock music. And they're fighting over this subjective problem. No, that's not what I want to hear my kids listening to. And yet, I understand what they're saying. You know, they want to protect their kids. But on the other hand, we're making these crazy, these ridiculous statements that rock music is wrong. And then we go out and we tune in Easy 101 while we listen to, or while we eat supper at home. And we don't realize it, but the musicians stand back and they say, "You Christians are ignorant." You see where we're headed? Very difficult to condemn something when you don't know what you're talking about, when you haven't taken time to define the issues. When we're taught in homiletics here, when we're preaching on a subject, we're always taught to define the subject. That's all I've done so far with rock. We've defined it. Let me play a couple of more examples here. Christian rock. The all-time number one selling gospel musical, Bill Gaither's Alleluia, the opening cut song from it, Let's Just Praise the Lord. That thing has swept the country. It's kind of amazing, isn't it? It's rock music and many people don't even know it. One more. This tape is just a little weak. I didn't have a chance to boost it today. But one of the hot vocalists is Sandy Patty's. One of her opening cuts off her opening album, Let There Be Praise. Little a cappella vocal section. And then when the song kicks in, you'll hear the rock beat. A little weaker, sorry about that. My point is simply this. We need to be able to define the topic to remove the subjectivity in the discussions that take place. Once we have an objective basis for a definition and we know what we're dealing with, then we begin to realize, I believe anyhow, that in and of itself, there's nothing immoral about the beat. It's the way that it's used. And of course, the way it's been used from the 50s on in our country, is linked up with all kinds of movements of rebellion and the taking over the college campuses and the whole schmear. We're going to go into some of that. Now, in the course of my dealings with people, I've listed what I feel are probably 10 of the major objections to rock music. And what I'd like to do is move through these. The first few will take us longer than the last several, simply because we're setting a groundwork. Let me work through them one at a time with you. We'll see some are valid and some are not. First objection that's listed is that the instruments used are sinful. Basically, people are referring to the guitar and the drums, I think. But the guitar and the drums are sinful. Let's take them one at a time. First of all, the guitar. It's a shame that that instrument has been considered by some to be a sinful instrument, simply because rock has been around since about the 50s. Before that, as far as I can tell in my history studies on the instrument, it really wasn't considered that. Oh, the saxophone was. I'll mention that in a minute. But interesting that the guitar wasn't. In fact, some of the reading, I think it was either Isby or Zondervan's Pictorial Bible Encyclopedia under musical instruments, when they were talking about the Old Testament instrument, the lyre, they were referring to how much it was similar to our modern-day guitar. Rather interesting comparison when some have accused the guitar of being a sinful instrument. You know, how can an instrument be sinful? Bob Larson, who has written several books on the topic of rock, been a pastor for a while in the West Coast, traveled extensively lecturing on this, he was saved out of a background of rock music, secular background of it. Listen to these words from Larson in his book, Rock. I enjoy some popular music myself. After all, before I became a Christian, music was my way of life. As a professional entertainer, I was immersed in the music of my day. I wrote it, I sang it, I played it. I still like a song with good rhythm. As a guitar player, and that's what he was, Segovia is not the only style I appreciate. Now, those of you who know something about Andres Segovia, I think he was born late 1800s. And if I'm not mistaken, just a couple of years ago, he died. I think I remember some of the hearing some of that on the news radio station out of Philadelphia. He was a classical guitarist, and that's what he's referring to. He enjoyed classical guitar, yes, but he's referring to more than that. It's not the instrument that's sinful. The drums. Again, it's a shame to think that the drums are considered to be an instrument that is evil. Rock's only been around since the 50s, and let's face it, we've certainly had drums long before that. Some of the connotations of the evilness of drums goes back before the day of rock, yes, but again, it was either Zondervan or Isby. I should have made a note of that here, but either Zondervan or Isby in their section under the musical instruments talks about the timbal of the Old Testament relating to the percussion family. Again, Larson's work on rock, he says this in regards to drums. I try to get a grip on this. Some evangelicals have a real hang-up regarding drums. Immediately after my conversion from the field of rock music, I did too. It wasn't long, though, before the Lord shattered my prejudices. While visiting New Zealand, I was privileged to hear a drum solo performed by a newly saved jazz musician. To the accompaniment of scripture reading, he audibly demonstrated the attributes of God. When God thundered from heaven, his bass drum nearly burst. The cadence of his snare brought forth visions of marching armies of the host of the Lord. As the Lord descended from on Sinai in his power and majesty, the drummer launched into a series of rolls and cymbal crashes. At the conclusion, I was breathless. What many would have considered the devil's instrument had ushered me into the presence of God and thereby destroyed my bias in the process. I don't know how you feel about that particular comment, but I think we need to at least realize that drums in and of themselves are not sinful instruments. We're doing an Easter cantata this Sunday night in our church. In our orchestra, we have two timpani. I just can't believe that drums are sinful. We have two timpani that are going to be there. The problem of the drum and the guitar here, I believe, really is a problem of association. People have associated these instruments with the secular rock scene that we have seen predominating since the 50s, into the 60s, and the rebellion, and the apathy, and the drugs, and the free sex, and the whole bit that goes with that kind of a movement. When I was a boy growing up in our church, we had a little church orchestra. It wasn't much, but every Sunday night we'd play with the hymns, and we had a great time. In the midst of one of our services, a professional musician, a saxophone player, got born again. And although previous to that, our pastor had preached about the sinfulness of the saxophone and how it was associated with the world, suddenly when this fellow got saved, he was incorporated into the church orchestra. And he even played solos in worship services. Now, I understand the mentality that says these things have been associated with the world. But then to turn around and accept them. I don't think because the world has taken something and used it and we associate it with them that it's necessarily wrong. And that's my point. God's standards do not change. We're going to be moving towards the area of holiness as we move through this. I don't think that this first objection is valid. I don't think the instruments are sinful. I think that they've been identified with very sinful movements in our world. The quality of music, the second objection, the quality of music is not good, it is said. Some would say, well, the musicians, they're not very good musicians. Ah, the music's not well written. It's overly simple. It's repetitious stuff. It's garbage music. It's no good. I've heard those kind of comments. Let me take them one at a time. Good musician, they're not good musicians. The music is not well written and that the music is overly simple. Performers are not good musicians, first of all. The thing that bothers me about that kind of a statement is that the people who often level those arguments are not musicians themselves. How can an untrained musical amateur really determine if a vocalist is using good vocal technique or an instrumentalist good instrumental technique? Take vocal just for a minute. Would the untrained person understand the use of vocal projection, of the resonating passages, the resonating chambers of the head, vocal placement in the three registers? I mean, how would the average person who doesn't understand vocal technique judge the performer and say they're not a good performer? I think what people mean when they say, oh, they can't sing, is they don't like their singing. Well, there's a difference. And to some people, yes, some people have more of a musical ear than others, yes. But to actually say that somebody is not a good musician. Back when I was in college, I had the privilege of studying trumpet with Don McComas, associate principal trumpeter in the Philly Orchestra. I studied with him for 5 years. One of my lessons, we were talking about the rock group Chicago. He had asked me if I heard him. I said, no, I hadn't. He commended their albums to me. He said, Dan, you need to understand that these fellas, these rock musicians, could sit first chair in any major symphony in our country. And he included his own in that, which was his own position. Now, certainly, they're an exception in the field. But when people make a broad generalization, oh, those rock musicians, they're all horrible. Well, that's true. But do poor performers mean that the style is wrong? Most of us have been in an experience in churches where we have had people that are less than professional and doing less than an acceptable job, really. We've heard them singing or playing. Poor performance doesn't make a musical style wrong. And yet those are the kind of things that are thrown up oftentimes as objections. Poor performance does not mean that a style of music is immoral. The second objection under this area, the music is not well written. Again, I've got to ask the question, is a person qualified to judge that? And this is even more difficult than the performer because most people have very little music theory training. They have very little music history background to understand if music is legitimate music or not as it compares to history. Do people understand the art of counterpoint, secondary dominant, chord structures, motif development, and on we could go. Different theory type constructions of music. If they don't, why would they say the music is poorly written? Do they know that? Rock in the 50s was a very simple form of rock, but today rock has gone to incredibly complex and sometimes chordal clusters, very advanced forms. Some of the stuff I was playing, it's almost difficult to hear the rock beat anymore. It's so complex in its instrumentation. But even if music is poorly written, does that mean that it's wrong? No. A good theorist, a good musician can open a hymn book and find some poorly written hymns. People don't understand that, though, because they don't understand music theory, and the hymn becomes a source of blessing to people, so they enjoy it. So people say, yeah, it's a good hymn. Well, do they mean it's... They don't mean necessarily it's musically good, though, do they? They mean they like it. That's what they mean. Third objection that is sometimes thrown up in the second category is that the music is overly simple. Again, in the 50s, basically rock tunes had three beats. A tonic, a dominant, a subdominant. With just four beats, or four chords, over and over and over again. It's kind of like the hymn, Count Your Many Blessings. Three chords, over and over again. Simple music is not necessarily immoral. There's some delightful little choruses that we sometimes sing in our church, worship choruses that are very simple. I don't know if you know this one, Make Me a Servant, Humble and Meek. Delightfully little simple song. There's nothing wrong with simplicity. I can't see where this stands as a valid objection. There are some valid ones, but I don't think necessarily this is. Beethoven wrote his Fifth Symphony with four notes, and he was considered a genius for it. Kind of interesting, isn't it? This third one, the beat is evil, becomes a very difficult thing. Perhaps some of you have done some reading in this area, and I'd appreciate hearing from you if you know something other than this. But basically, this argument goes like this. Rock music is a form of music from Satan. It had its origins in the jungles of Africa. The syncopated beat is immoral, and it's too up-tempo. I want to take each of those four things and break them down briefly. Rock music is a form of music from Satan. I don't believe that Satan creates. I believe God creates. I don't believe man creates. We certainly arrange many of the things that God has put into creation. We certainly find many of those things. But I don't think Satan created music. Satan didn't create rock, neither did man. Rock music is a style of music. That is, it has been arranged into that style by mankind. But let's say for a moment that Satan was the mastermind behind it. Let's say that he's the guy that dreamed it up. Just because he dreamed it up, does that mean that it couldn't be used in some pure form? That's a good question. We're going to have to deal with that a little bit later. But that question, I think, has to come out at this point. It's not just rock music that it has its problems with morality. Many styles of music do. When I was in college, I had the opportunity to play a job outside the school. We were doing a Bach oratorio, and the trumpet parts in those things are just brutal. But you love to do it because you're kind of glutton for punishment as a student, so I had the opportunity to play first chair in this thing. And when I was in this orchestra with a whole bunch of other students from the Philadelphia area, three or four of these guys, they were unsaved. They were joking about how they had found they could manipulate a certain gal in the violin section by the playing of a certain song by Beethoven. Now, I'm not ready to condemn and say all Beethoven's music is immoral, but there are some principles that we're going to need to draw about that in a few minutes to help us sort that issue out. No style in and of itself, in my opinion, is immoral. It's the way that man uses them. Man is the one to blame, not a style of music, no matter what the style. Again, listen to Larson as he speaks on this kind of a concept that the music was from Satan. As the beat of contemporary Christian music grew louder and stronger, the voices of dissent were raised. Mine was one of them. I saw something disturbing happening and taking place in the often defiant rejection of strict biblical guidelines for musical expression. A poor imitation of the world's music and lifestyle was not the way to reach sin-sick kids in our society who were looking for a way out. Quite frankly, I saw no hope that an authentic, spiritually viable idiom of musical expression could come out of such confusion. It seemed impossible that these gospel rock artists, so to speak, would ever mellow out and mature into composers and singers who would explore themes of depth and commitment worthy of acceptance by the church. And then he says, but in many ways I was dead wrong. And he goes on, and he did a change of heart in this particular book. His earlier ones had been strongly against any kind of rock, and then all of a sudden he realized we got to define rock, and he realized that he had thrown the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. I respect him for understanding he had missed some things. Second area under this third objection, rock came from the jungles of Africa. I've read that statement. I've heard it. I found one book that had a footnote in it. I went back. I checked it in the public library. Didn't check. I can't find validation for this. In a few places, I have read the comment that those who have raised this objection are really raising an objection of basically a black-white issue, a skin color issue. It's a racial comment. Now, it's hard to know, of course, what the motivations were of the people who originally raised this objection, but I've yet to see it. But let's say for a moment it did come from the jungle tribes of Africa, and it was a satanic beat out of some satanic tribe out there somewhere. Paint the worst picture you can of it. Again, does that mean that the style is wrong? And I respond, no, man is wrong for the way he's used it. Difficult issue. Third, syncopation is wrong. Again, I define it as Harvard does in his dictionary. Syncopation is nothing more than altering the beat from the place where it normally is to a place where it's not expected. Classical music is loaded with it. If you're going to say rock is wrong because of syncopation, then we need to throw out 90% of classical music too, because it's loaded with syncopation. In fact, the little song, "Since Jesus came into," that's syncopation. Syncopation isn't wrong. It's a musical device that adds interest to a musical composition. Fourth, is it too up-tempo? Well, as I did this study, I closed the door of my office and I turned the radio on when the top 40 rock hits were playing, and I kept the volume down so nobody would know what I was doing. And I metronomically timed the top 40 on the chart at that time, and the average metronomic beat came to about 124 beats per minute, which is the tempo which we sing Onward Christian Soldiers to. Nothing wrong with a tempo, but in fact, I have an edition for trumpet of Rimsky-Korsakov's Flight of the Bumblebee, which measures in at 166 on the metronome. That's flying. That's really moving. You know what a metronome is? The thing goes back and forth and keeps time for a musician. What I think these people are saying when they say this music is too up-tempo, and they use a different pen this time, another one blew up on you. What I think they're saying is this. Before I show it to you, let me play an example of it. Watch. One, two, three. That's really driving. Right? Onward, Christian soldiers. Nothing wrong with the tempo, but people say that's up tempo. What's going on? They've taken a subdivision and they've doubly subdivided it. Instead of eights, they've made it into 16s. So instead of getting that, it's really driving hard. People don't know how to express that, so they call it up tempo. Nothing wrong with the tempo. Fast music is not bad, and slow music good, musically speaking. Some of you are getting a little nervous. Hang on. We'll get to where you want to be in a little bit, but we're going to get there the right way. The fourth objection, the style of music is worldly. I want to read a quotation from a Moody Monthly article back in 1970 by Don Wurtson, who has a master's in Bible, or MDiv, I believe, out of Dallas, and also a master's in music. Very qualified man to speak on this topic. He says, when you look at church history, you find that Martin Luther created a whole fresh new body of church music. He took the Bible, which up until that time had been in Latin, and put it in German so that people could read it in their own language. He also put the music in the sound of his day. He even took some songs that were in the local pubs and taverns and put solid Christian theology to one of them. One of these songs is, you ready for this? O Sacred Head Now Wounded. Now, wait a minute. The accusation is that the style is worldly. That means that in Martin Luther's day, if it was wrong to do that, it's right today, and God's standards in that area have changed. I'm not prepared to say that. I'm prepared to say that that's a matter of association. We associate it in our minds. I'm sure Martin Luther took his licks for bringing a barroom tune into the church. But interesting, isn't it? We don't consider it worldly anymore. It's an association type of a thing. Wurtson challenges us to rethink that kind of an objection. A couple of more examples. Revive Us Again, the hymn, from the tune Hallelujah, I'm a Bum, or as some sang it, Haley, You're a Bum. The tune for A Christmas Carol, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, comes from a song that was a praise to Gutenberg's press. Secular connotation, maybe not a bad one, but a secular connotation. A Mighty Fortress Is Our God by Luther. The tune was a song that was sung in the beer gardens of Germany. Luther wanted a tune that was known to the people to put that text to, and he found one. God's standard for holiness do not change. Our limited understanding of music and what we associate it with are what's changing, and it's changing all the time. We have an association problem when it comes to these styles. As soon as we turn on that tape recorder and we hear that music, we think world, movement going on since 50s and 60s, and now getting more complex. Drugs, sex, free sex, immorality, rebellion. We think that whole movement, association. And yet we turn right around and we hear it in the dentist office in a different form that doesn't associate with that movement. We turn right around and we sing Bill Gaither's Alleluia, Let's Just Praise the Lord. And we never even make the connection of the inconsistency. Let's move on to the next one. Time's going to go short on us. Dislike of the music. This is the first objection I think I can 100% validate. I think this is perfectly fine. People have the right to say, I don't care for a particular style of music. Our senior pastor retired at the end of the year. He did not like classical music in any way, shape, or form. He liked country western, and I don't like country western. We used to tease one another a lot about it, but we personally did not cut the other's music down. I love classical music. He didn't cut mine down. He used to sometimes call it funny music or different things like that. But nervous music was another big title for it. And I had a few little jabs for him on country western. But you see, there's got to be a healthy balance between saying, I don't care for this style of music. It's just not personally pleasing to me. That's fine. But towing the mark there as opposed to going and saying, it's wrong. I don't like it. It's wrong. You see, there's a balance point there that's necessary. We need to be able to dislike a style of music without condemning it if somebody else likes it. F, the music is too loud. This is another legitimate point, I think. At certain rock concerts that I've read about, they've measured the sound levels going on in the room. The measurement of sound, of course, is the decibel. And they found that rock concerts measure in anywhere between 100 to 130 decibels, at least the ones that were measured that I read about. Now, in case you don't understand the decibel levels, let me just give you a little idea on them. 20 decibels are leaves rustling outside in the breeze. 40 decibels is a typewriter in a small room. I'm going to build. 60 decibels is the average office noise in an average office. 70 decibels, a busy city street, downtown city street. 100 decibels, a subway station with a sub going by. 120 to 130 decibels where the rock concerts peak out. A jet plane close at hand. The human ear can basically be damaged where there is consistent sound levels of 100 to 130. Now, for rockers that are damaging their ears, that's certainly not being good stewards of their body, is it? But it seems to me, although this is a very valid objection, the answer is rather simple. The style of music is not wrong because it's loud. Just turn it down. seems to me to be the logical thing here. G, music is a sign of rebellion. Of course, I've been hinting at this already, so I won't spend too long. College campus takeovers, revolution, rebellion, drugs, alcohol, free sex, apathy. If you think of the Beatles, that's what you think of. As soon as I turn that tape recorder on and you hear that, you just know what goes through your mind. It's an association type of a thing. I just think we've got to be careful about throwing the baby out with the bathwater, especially when we're already using Bill Gaither's Alleluia in the church, and musicians are saying, what's the matter? Don't you guys realize that you're being inconsistent with these ridiculous comments? H, the words are immoral and suggestive. I don't think anybody can doubt that in regards to rock music. But let's face it, immoral words don't make a style wrong. Luther's proved that to us. With a mighty fortress is our God, using it in the beer gardens. With, O sacred head now wounded, we sang that in our communion service not long ago. It's an associational problem here. Let me move on to I. The lives of the performers are corrupt. There's no doubt about that in the movement which we've seen. But there's an important flaw here that's got to be recognized. And that is that all the corrupt musicians of the world could not make a style of music corrupt. They could sing that and they could play it in a corrupt manner, but they can't corrupt the style. And certainly everything that they're doing is wrong. But they will give an account for that. The style of music won't. J. This music ruins the lives of those who listen to it. There's not a doubt about that. And I don't doubt that Christian young people have been led astray through this. I'm positive of it. I've been in those kind of situations where I've seen kids get messed up with this stuff. But again, I have to say that the wrong use of a style doesn't make it wrong. The wrong use of humor doesn't make humor wrong. The wrong use of sex doesn't make sex wrong. It's not the style that's wrong. It's the way it's being used. Well, those are the objections. Let's move on into this area of the specific principles. I've listed three principles for you. The filter principle is an important one. The first one here, Philippians 4:8, is a verse that's familiar, I think, to most of us. I'm reading from the NIV. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Now, we don't have time to do a nice exposition of this, but what I want you to see here is that this verse can function as a principle, a filter for everything in our lives. I'm applying it, of course, in the area of music, particularly rock. But I think when we approach any issue of life, and we're using rock tonight as our issue, we want to be sure that in the selection of any music which we're going to listen to, that it's true, that it's noble, that it's right, that it's pure, that it's lovely, that it's admirable. Does the music that you listen to, whether it's rock or not, does it fit that kind of a classification? You can do that with your television viewing. You know, it's not just rock. Country Western is loaded with truck drivers shacking up with waitresses. Now you see, now I'm moving towards holy living. Opera, great classical stuff that it is, socially acceptable, but is often loaded with corruption and immorality. It's not the style that's wrong. It's the way it's used. That's my point. As we select our music, as we do anything in life, as we watch television, the programs that we're watching, are they true? Are they noble? Are they right, pure, lovely, admirable? There's your filter. I think you could almost stop with the first principle. There's some other good points, too, I think, in the other principles. But, boy, there's a lot to consider there. Now you're beginning to see why I call this rock music a call to holiness. Let me show you a little more with the second one. The brinkmanship principle. Perhaps you've heard this before. I've heard messages on it. And I've just tagged it in here because I think it's so fitting. I'm using the text in Matthew chapter 5, verse 48. And I'm quoting it from the King James. Be ye holy, even as I am holy. NIV uses the word perfect. Be ye perfect, even as I am perfect. But since I've called this rock music, I'm quoting King James. Be ye holy, even as I am holy. This brinkmanship principle seems to be that Christians today are asking the wrong question. They're asking, if this is sin over here, how close to the brink of sin can I come and still be okay? I'm not sinning yet. I think I've given this lecture probably 30 times. And never once has anybody asked me the question, will rock music help me conform more to the image of Christ? No, the question is it okay? See? You know, how close can I get till I tip? It seems to me that if we're going to live holy, be ye holy, even as I am holy, that we're not going to work with the questions towards the edge. We're going to work the opposite way. We're asking the wrong question. Is rock music all right? That's not the right question. The question is not how much can I get away with and still be okay. We're caught up with all kinds, and I think this is true of many issues in life, not just rock. Bottom line, I think it's a lordship issue. Have we really settled the lordship issue? The questions I'm asked are, Dan, tell us the answer about rock music. Is it right? Is it wrong? Tell us. And then after you tell us, we'll decide if we're going to do something about it or not. That's a lordship problem. That's a holiness problem. And third, the erratic principle, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22. I've selected this one. I reworked this thing recently because I've been poring over the pastoral epistles and looking to God for wisdom about a decision that I'm trying to make in my own work. Flee the evil desires of youth. The erotic principle, not erratic, erotic sexual connotations, erotic. Flee the evil desires of youth, NIV says, and then it puts it in the positive. Instead of, you know, dealing with evil desires, pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, along with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart. 2 Timothy 2:22. The negative, flee evil desires of youth. The erratic principle is simply this. Any music which causes an erratic reaction within you is absolutely wrong. If any kind of music causes an immoral response in thought, it's wrong for you. Now, you recall that young lady I had mentioned before that the fellows in the orchestra I played in thought, you know, were laughing how they could manipulate her with a particular song of Beethoven. I'm not saying that song of Beethoven is wrong. What I'm saying is that it's wrong for her. There's a certain point at which all music is erotic for all of us. But then for each of us, there are some other points as well. As sexual beings, there are different things that cause each of us to respond differently. So there's two issues here. There is some music that's out because it's erotic for everybody, and then there's some music that may be out because it's erotic for you. Do you know what your limit is? And if so, are you willing to live in light of that? Are you willing to go the opposite way instead of toward the brink? How close can I get to my level? Let me just close this section with a couple of further comments to apply these principles. I think that as you begin to use these three principles in the selection of any music, you've got to ask questions like, what do the words say? And then you go back to Philippians 4:8. Pour it through that filter. You've got to ask questions about the performers' lives. I have strong convictions that even if you could find a song by Black Sabbath that there was nothing wrong with, it would be wrong for me, for you, I believe this, it would be wrong to spend your money on that album because every album that Black Sabbath sells is royalties for them. They're members of the Satan's Church of Los Angeles, Satanic Church of America. And Satanic Church of America, I also understand, gets some royalties off some of their albums. So if you're going to buy their album, you're going to support them. So as you use these three principles, you're going to have to know something about the people that are behind the songs that you like. That's a rather difficult task. It's a complex world that we're living in. And I think you've also got to closely examine the music to see if it's overshadowing the words, if the song has words. Music should never overshadow the text of a song. Thursday night, we have a dress rehearsal for our cantata. And with our orchestra, the nightmare of the night is to get that orchestra to play softly enough and controlled enough so that they're not overshadowing the music or the words from the choir. And if they are, we got to cut the orchestra. We almost did at Christmas time, but all of a sudden they realized that they weren't going to play. So, boy, everybody calmed way down. We got it down under control. If music overshadows a text, something's wrong. I think those are the kind of questions that you've got to be asking. Let me make several suggestions in regards to this whole rock music talk to conclude it. First of all, several suggestions. First, sit down with every tape, disc, record, album in your possession and determine if those tapes, albums, and so on fit the criteria of the three principles. Not just rock. I'm talking the country western stuff, the blues, the classics, the operas. I mean, get it all out and honestly go through it as an exercise of holy living. Be holy as I am holy. As you do that, some of you, if you have teenage kids, I don't know if any of you have that point just yet, but I noted that when some of our parents were willing to do this, you don't just get the kids' albums out. Mom and Dad had to bring their country westerns out too. And together they just agreed, and all of a sudden there was a whole new air of communication between kids and parents on this issue. They had an objective definition. They could identify rock, and then they could listen and begin to understand in light of these other principles. Is this something that's going to help us conform to the image of Christ? And see, we had a more objective base for analysis, and it cut down the arguments and stop World War III. It was a peace treaty. Number two, I would suggest reading about the performers. Remember, not everything you read is absolutely true, unless, of course, you're in the scriptures. But even in reading of some of the articles or occasionally on some of these spot programs, like, what are they? I don't watch enough TV to know. Some of these talk-type programs on TV, like a 2020 Vision or whatever they are, you know, where they have different segments and sometimes they have performers on there, you'll get to know a lot about the characteristics of a particular person's life that way. I think that's a real possibility. Third, I'd like to suggest the replacement principle. If you're going to take something out of your musical library, I think the scriptural context is when you put off, you put on. So if you're going to cut something out of your musical tastes, you probably need to add something in its place. If you've been a secular rocker before tonight, I hope you will do some very serious analysis in regards to that about your spiritual life, and maybe you'll look for some alternatives. I believe that there are some fine contemporary Christian musicians, and I would classify their music as rock like Gaither was on this particular thing. I think there are some good ones around. I'll just name some that I particularly have found to be rather decent. Petra is one. I spent some time studying one of their albums with our young people, Not of This World. We went through every one of their songs, and I think without exception on that album, every one of their songs were paraphrased or quotations of Scripture. Now, I understand that we still have an association problem in our minds, but if you're a person who has enjoyed rock and you're looking for an alternative, I would commend Petra to you. I commend Rick Kua, Vlad, DeGarmo and Key, Rob Frazier, Pastor Frazier, Warrington Fellowship, his son, Rob Frazier, and Whiteheart. I don't know everything there is to know about all those groups, but what I've heard some of their tapes. I think they're pretty decent. There are dozens of them. Just a casual viewing of the tapes in a Christian bookstore nowadays up here at Provident in Sauterton. There are dozens of these groups around today. Fourth, I'd like to suggest that you would broaden out musical styles. We all have our favorite styles, but listen to something that is not your favorite style. Example of this, for a year while we were at First Baptist, my wife and I were renting a house in Shelfont before we were able to buy our handyman special that we're in now. Across the street from us there's a man who taught music in the Central Buck School District. Music teacher, good musician. And for the life of him, he couldn't get his kid to listen to some classical music. His kid was the bass guitarist in the big rock band in Central Buck School District area. Well, I'm leaving this vague enough, I don't think any of you would know him. But poor kid, I still feel badly for him. One day when nobody was around, after his dad had nagged at him for a long time, he finally popped a Tchaikovsky record on, and he loved it. I never told his friends. But all of a sudden, when he listened to something that he didn't necessarily like, he found out he enjoyed it. So my encouragement would be broaden out in musical styles. Listen to something that's a little out of your comfort zone. Learn to enjoy it. Won't be your favorite style, I recognize that. Listen to some Baroque trumpet music. It's great stuff. It really is. I love it. I need to listen to some other things. Fifth, don't condemn somebody else's music if they like it. We can be more tolerant than that of each other. Now, this is taking for granted that there's not immorality involved in the music and so on, that it's not breaching the principles. If the principles are violated, then you're not condemning the style of music that they like. Then you're going after the issues and the performers and the word writers and so on. What's going on? Sixth, when there are teens in the audience, when I give this, I like to encourage them to obey their parents. And I usually also encourage them, why do you expect your parents to make all the decisions the way you want them to? Why do you think that mom and dad can't sometimes even make a bad decision? If you go home tonight and they still say no rock music, even after the seminar, then it's no rock music. You've got to give mom and dad slack. They don't have to be perfect just because they're your parents. That kind of a thrust. And seven, some of you may very well be leadership in a local church. I would strongly encourage you to consider adopting a positional statement for your church on the use of different styles of music. And over here I have some other papers. I have a short bibliography of five books that I think are especially good in this topic. And next to that, I have our positional statement, which we drew for First Baptist. I'll read it briefly to you. Styles of music. It is the position of our church that we will take a balanced approach to musical styles. We believe that our music should represent the general likes of our people. In other words, even though I see nothing wrong with the style of rock per se, I'm not going to put a rock band on our platform on Sunday morning. That's ridiculous. We believe that our music should represent the general likes of our people. The styles of music used will be determined in light of the group to whom we are ministering. Contextualization. Guidelines for the use of music are, and then I've listed the guidelines similar to what you have there. It is therefore our position that no style of music in and of itself is morally wrong. We will attempt to use those styles of music which comfortably minister to the majority of the people to whom we are ministering. With our young people, we do use contemporary Christian music. But we don't use it in the worship service because there we're going to have all kinds of problems and we're going to cause division. But our parents know, this is our statement, they know what we're doing with their young people. And there's an air of satisfaction. Our parents and a lot of our teens have sat down and worked this thing out together. Eighth and finally, I would suggest that if you're fairly ignorant of this whole area like I was, do what I did. Go visit a record shop and look at the album covers. You will learn so much just by looking at the secular rock album covers, and you'll get a very good drift for what a particular rock group stands for. You've got a kid that likes such and such a group, you don't have time or money to invest in listening and buying those albums, but boy, you can tell a lot just by looking at the jacket. Those are the comments that I wanted to share with you. I hope you found it to be profitable. I'd be more than glad to stay as long as you'd like to entertain your questions. Thank you. Yeah, a couple questions there. Interesting.